Sairam, dear listeners, and welcome to the second afternoon satsang in the month of June. As always, I'm Arvind from Team Radio Sai, and with me is Brother Prem, and we both offer our most humble pranams at the lotus feet of our ever-present Swami. You know, June is that time of the year when it is a new beginning for a major part of the world, possibly. At least in India, this is the time when schools reopen, and so the summer vacation is complete and the children have to go back to school. I know that the summer vacation in different parts of the country is different, but in India, this is the time when summer vacations end. And when they go back to the schools, it is a new beginning. The examinations are over, you have been evaluated, the tests have been conducted, and you are about to make a fresh beginning in the next year of your student career. Now, though people who are working, the working class, going to offices, going to the companies, going different places for their daily work, though they do not have a thing called summer vacation, somehow it so happens that the summer is the time when they take their vacations, because that is the time when the children are free to go for vacation. So you will notice that in the summer, most of the earned leaves and casual leaves that the workers and employees of any organization or any company have, they will be used up. So all of them will be going on their vacations. So in a way, even for them, the June is like the time when we get back seriously to business and start working. While that is the case for these children, the students and the workers in the world generally, in the spiritual world, you know, whether we are in the kindergarten or whether we are teenagers or whether we are workers or whether we are managers, in the spiritual field, we do not have anything called a vacation. Because spirituality is possibly what I can call as CIE. I'm sure, Prem, you remember the CIE tests that we used to have in the university, continuous internal evaluation.
Right.
I think though that term was used for those sudden tests and tests during any time of the week, any time of the month, at any time of the year to test whether how updated you are on the subject, I think the term CIE is so perfect when we want to measure our progress or our growth on the spiritual field, because, you know, it is continuous internal evaluation.
Right, it's continuous, it's internal, and it's got to be an evaluation all the time. And, you know, we've mentioned it many times before, the conversation which Anil Kumar Sir had with Swami once, when he asked Swami, what is sadhana? You know, The analogy which Swami gave was so beautiful. He said it's like that bus which goes on a dusty road.
Okay.
And, you know, you would always find the cloud of dust behind the road, behind the bus as the bus rides.
Especially on Indian roads.
Right, especially on Indian, you know, the
village roads.
That's what Swami was saying. The moment the bus stops, the cloud which was till then outside the bus would come into the bus. Mm. And Swami would say, that's how sadhana should be. Always there is maya behind you, and you should do sadhana, and as long as you do sadhana, the maya will be after you, but it will not catch up with you. Mm-hmm. But the moment you stop, it's like the bus coming to a halt, and then the maya will come and, you know, encircle you.
In other words, in the spiritual field, progress is actually maintenance. Because as long as the bus is moving, the dust does not get into the bus. The minute the bus stops, you know, bus stops doesn't mean it's going in reverse. But if the bus stops itself, the dust comes in. Which means, as long as the bus is progressing, it is able to maintain a relatively dust-free environment. So too, in spiritual life, in our sadhana, we have to be continuously at it, because that is needed not for progress, that is needed for maintenance.
Absolutely, because many times Swami has made this very important point that sadhana is not something you do for something which you will receive in future.
Mm.
You know, it is not for the state of becoming, but it is for a state of being. You do it to be in something, and that's something which we miss out. Because very often whenever we talk about spiritual life, the thing which Swami says is do it for the sake of doing and not for the result. You know, don't do it with the result in mind. But that very spiritual sadhana itself, we do it for some result in mind. Because that's why Swami says that always spiritual worship or sadhana is for the present moment, and it's not for something which you will receive in the future.
You know, ideally we should transpose this spiritual message That is the central message of the Bhagavad Gita 2, where Lord Krishna says there are karmas and there are karyas. He says there's a difference, you know, both of them. See, that is the beauty of Sanskrit, or what can you say, the lack of appropriate words in English. Karma will be translated into action and karya will be translated into action. But Krishna says that, you know, karmas are actually binding actions, while karyas are non-binding actions. And Krishna says, all karmas are karyas, but all karyas need not be karmas.
Okay.
And he says, when you have the desire for the result of the action, then it becomes a karma, because you are bound by it now, because you are attached. That word itself says, you are attached to the result of the action. I have done this, therefore I have to get this. And you are attached to the result and therefore it becomes karma. You are bound to it. The non-binding action is a karya. He says, you do your effort, but you don't bother whether the result is going to be A or B. Your joy lies in just doing the effort. This is what we spoke about. And when you do that, you are not attached to the fruits of the action. You are not attached to the result of the action, which means you are not attached to that action, which means it's non-binding. So therefore, Krishna tells Arjuna, you know, as long as you ensure that all the acts you do are karyas and not karmas, till then you cannot be, you know, happy. And that is what I feel comes into when what we are discussing now also, that we don't do it for something in the future. We do it for the present state. The bus is running and presently no dust is entering. It is not as if I keep running, in the future also dust will not enter.
In fact, you know, there's one quote which I read sometime back which is so beautiful. It says, when the only residue of all your actions becomes only love, then you're free from your actions.
Wow. Free from the actions itself.
Actions itself. Because, you know, you're not being bound by what you do. Because whatever we do, there is always, you know, there is a byproduct other than love. Now, love is supposed to be the only product, but there's so many other byproducts. And he says that only when the love alone is the residue for all the actions, then you don't have to think about whether the actions are going to bind you or not.
Wow. So that is, I think, the ultimate. You know, the thing is, when we are speaking about progress being maintenance on the spiritual field, so it becomes so difficult to know what is progress then. Because what is, in other terms, is considered progress. When a bus is moving forward, we say it is moving, it's advancing. But in the analogy that Swami has given us in spirituality, when we are actually progressing, we are just maintaining. So what then is progress? Now that itself is so tough to determine. And we have now embarked on a journey. On a journey which is part two today, on how do we measure the progress. Oh my God, that is definitely going to be a challenge, right?
Yeah, it is. But I think understandably all of us want to know that. Because when we say that you have to do it without the eye on the progress, when you say that, you know, this is something which you do it for maintaining your spiritual state, obviously we're not in that perfect state. We're not in that ideal state.
It's not incentive enough.
Right. We are trying to achieve something. And as we mentioned last time, we are people who have replaced, to an extent, worldly goals with spiritual ones. So we do have that necessity to know whether we are doing at least correctly what we are trying to do.
Yeah, this is what, you know, this happens especially when we enter the spiritual field. We try to, you know, put these spiritual ideals into our worldly life. You know, the first point that we discussed last time was you should not separate things as worldly and spiritual. You have to, because that is a sure shot downfall. But till we get there, you know, till we start doing that, actually we still feel some things are spiritual, some things are worldly. And for example, I feel my career is worldly, me pursuing my job is worldly. So I try to spiritualize the worldly things and therefore try to apply these principles where, okay, I'll also go and work. I will not work for targets. I'll work, I'll slog, I will struggle and strive just for the joy that I get by struggling and striving. I will not keep my eye on the results always, so that when I achieve it, I don't get elated, and when I don't achieve it, I don't get depressed. So, like we try to take these spiritual concepts and apply it into our day-to-day life, sometime, as you said, the reverse also takes place, where what we are taught to apply by the so-called world starts percolating into our spiritual life too. In the world, we are told that it is bound by targets, it's a target based, it's you have to measure, it's monitored, we have examinations, we have evaluations, we have performance appraisals. So naturally we feel, why not have the same even for our spiritual life? So how do I measure the progress that I make in spiritual life?
And added to that, there's another confusion, you know, there's another equation which confuses this whole thing.
Hmm.
Which is told in so many ways. Swami says, you take one step towards me, I'll take 10. Sometimes Swami says, people quote it as 100, sometimes people quote it as 1,000.
Yeah.
So you don't know how many steps it is. So you don't know how fast you're progressing, because, you know, that much shorter your destination is getting. So you absolutely have no idea. It's not just based on your steps also. And interestingly, you know, somebody was explaining, you know, talking about this thing. He made an observation which was very beautiful. He said, see, Swami is only telling you half the truth.
Hmm.
He says, when you take one step towards him, let it be any number, let's fix it at 10 for now.
Okay.
He says, when you take one step towards Swami, Swami takes 10 steps, but he takes 10 silent steps.
Hmm.
He says, not always you will see Swami coming close to you. And the challenge is, will you still take that second step when you don't see that Swami is coming 10 steps closer to you?
Wow.
And he said, that's the spiritual challenge that Swami is throwing at us. So.
And the other unknown here is Prem. What is the distance between me and the Lord?
Exactly.
Is it 100 steps? Is it 1,000 steps? And you know, it is just poetry when we say, it's a metaphor when we say 10 steps or 100 steps. And it's poetry when we say that, oh, the Lord actually white and the Lord takes a million steps. We may quote like that in poetry. But as you say, when it comes to quantifying and actually, it's only half the truth that we know.
Yes, that the analogy which Swami says about, and Draupadi was being dishonored in the court.
Mm, in the Mahabharata. Mm.
Right, you know, Swami says that many times in the discourses. She first called out 2-3 times and Krishna never responded.
Mm.
And then when she later confronts Krishna and says, why did you take so much time to come to my rescue? And then Krishna explains, see, first you called me Mathuranatha, which means you perceived me as somebody who stays in Mathura. I had to come all the way from there.
Hmm, from Mathura to Hastinapura, yeah.
Right, and then you said, oh, you know, the Lord of Vrindavan. So that again is too far. And then finally when you said, oh, Hridayavasi Krishna, come to my rescue. And that's when, you know, the distance which you perceived became so small and I could respond to you.
Beautiful. So dear listeners, this is actually part 2 of the satsang on how do I measure this my spiritual progress. In part 1, I'll quickly summarize what we had discussed in part 1. Spiritual progress is measured by, first point, how less I separate things or events and experiences as worldly and spiritual. We should never separate things as worldly and spiritual, and this was highlighted with the experience of Professor Bhagya from the Satya Sai University here, where Swami told him that if you do so, I will never grant you what you wish for 1,000 years from now.
Right.
And all that he wished was spiritual enlightenment. Therefore, when we don't separate things as worldly and spiritual, what happens is work automatically transforms into worship and duty automatically becomes God. So this is one sure shot indicator of progress. The second thing is being self-directed rather than circumstance-directed. You know, it is easy to be peaceful in the jungle, but one must be able to do so and be peaceful in the city. It is easy to meditate and do bhajans when things are fine in life. But what about when things go awry? So basically, self-directed person is able to steer his or her ship in a tempest and not only in the calm seas. So this is the second way to measure our progress.
Okay.
But you know, both these one and two, that is not separating things as worldly and spiritual, and the other thing of being self-directed and not circumstance-directed, are qualitative measures. We want a quantitative measure. That is what exams are. That is what a performance appraisal is. And therefore, some of the quantitative methods is the amount of silence we practice. And for that, we gave many examples of how Swami made use of physical silence to teach devotees and students. We also discussed how many times in life, simple physical silence itself helps us.
Right.
Helps us to overcome situations where the best answer, the best possible answer is silence. But then physical silence is a good first step. The actual silence is the internal silence. And we can also measure this internal silence. Two ways with which we can measure the internal silence was discussed where. First one is the number of times that we get either excited or depressed, that is basically we lose equilibrium. So that is the frequency of excitation and depression. And the second thing is the amount of time each bout of such excitement or depression lasts. So that is the intensity of the excitement or depression. So reducing both the frequency and the intensity naturally shows increased progress. So this is the story so far.
Right, I think there are a lot of points. Wonder how much each of those makes sense. But you know, as you said, we are doing something which is very, very difficult. You know, as we set out, we are saying that this is not, we are not supposed to be done, but still we're doing it. You know, because as we said, we are so desperate to know, you know, how far we have come. And more than desperate to know how far we have come, I think that question of, are we doing the right thing? You know, are we really doing the right thing? You might have done for 15 years, 20 years. And, you know, there was one joke which someone was telling. There was one person who was telling him that, you know, sir, I've been telling this mantra for the past 15 years and it's not worked out for me. So the person asked, what is the mantra it is? So this person just recited that mantra and he told it with so many flaws.
Mm.
Okay, and this boy was thinking, no wonder nothing has happened for 15 years.
Oh.
And he said, sir, you've learnt it wrong. This is the way it has got to be chanted.
And he feels that 15 years of his life are down that
drain. Yeah, I don't know. It's definitely in spirituality, it's not like that. You know, it's something which we've spoken about before. You cannot carry forward, you cannot carry forward the money you've earned, the name and fame you've earned. But that which you earn in the physical journey is always carried forward.
In the spiritual journey.
Sorry, in the spiritual journey is always carried forward, and that's what makes it special. So nothing is waste, but all said and done, you always have that fear. Am I doing the right thing? Am I going in the right direction?
And you know, the way they speak in the world about inheritance, you know, inheritance in the terms of genetics, that what your ancestors were, you inherit those. Isn't it surprising that things like attitude and character, these are not actually inherited? Of course, they help. You know, it helps to have a good family, and there are greater chances that a good family produces a child which is filled with character. But there are so many families that have gone awry and yet produced children, men and women of great character.
Right.
The other thing also holds good. You know, a good family may result in a child without a good character. So when you see these things, character, attitude, these are not genetic. Then what is it? The only possible explanation, if we think logically, is what you just now said, Prem, that the spiritual journey is a continuous one and it carries across lifetimes. It is not like our wealth and status which stops in this lifetime. It is something, you know, genetics is one level deeper. It carries on to generations of my same physical family at least, which other things might not carry on. My fame, my son might not inherit. How many times we have seen children of great sports stars or great president, great politicians, great presidents, great people, great scientists, the children measure nowhere near them. In fact, you know, I heard that sometime that some of the ancestors of great kings of India, like Tipu Sultan and different people, currently they are in a very bad state in all terms, socially, financially. I had read it in the newspaper sometime back, which shows that that doesn't carry. But at least the genetics carries on, you know, the genes, the system of fighting against disease, your immunity. Mm-hmm. For example, your immunity carries across 5-6 generations, 10 generations.
Right.
So there are some things that carries across that. But that too is within the family. But as you rightly said, the spiritual journey does not matter. You might be born as an animal the next birth for all that you know. But any effort done for or against on the spiritual field always counts. And it sticks for lifetimes.
You know, there was one discourse I was listening to about the Bhagavad Gita, a discourse by one of the saints of the Ramakrishna order. And a very young saint, he was explaining very beautifully. He took a couple of verses in the Bhagavad Gita, in which one, Krishna says that you have nothing under your control.
Mm.
Okay, because one thing, he talks about karma being the overruling factor in every decision you make and the vasanas which you carry forward. So then Arjuna asks him, then what is there in my control?
Mm.
Okay, because if everything is preordained and if everything is something or the other is driving me to take decisions and make choices, then what is there in my control? then, you know, this saint goes on to tell a very beautiful thing. He says that between that which is not under your control and that which the choice you make, there is a very, very small window of discrimination. And he said, all learning, all education and all spiritual practices is to empower you in that small window, to make you, you know, make that decision. And though when we say that you don't carry forward good character, and, you know, character is not inherited over the family, the reason why, you know, a good quality in your father, you are most likely to inherit it.
Yeah, there's a greater chance.
Right, greater chance, because that small window of control which is there in your hand in this birth gets empowered. And that is why a good family is always necessary. You know, Swami has always spoken about idealism. Teachers have to be ideals. Parents have to be ideals. Because that small window which is there in our control gets empowered when put in the right conditions. And I think that's what we are trying to do here. You know, when you talk of spiritual practices, when you talk of doing bhajans, doing seva, you are trying to empower that small part of you which can pull you out of this circumstance which you've got yourself into over many births of actions.
And that brings us to another interesting way in which we can measure our spiritual progress. Because from what we discussed, if we empower that window of making proper choices, if that is right, then making choices in life should become progressively easier.
Absolutely.
So, one more possible way to measure our spiritual progress is the ease with which we make our choices.
Right.
And not, of course, when we say make the choices, these are not choices which we repent later. So shall we say it as the ease with which we make our choices, the choices by which we stand by for ages to come.
Right.
So the ease with which we make those choices is another sign of spiritual progress.
Very
the
true.
Easier and faster we make, the better.
Absolutely, because you know, we always glorify taking that right choice when there is a moral dilemma. But actually what you're trying to do is reach towards that state where there is no dilemma. Where there is the other choice does not tempt you at all. You always are going for the right choice. You know, the temptation of taking to the wrong path is not there at all. That's what we mean by saying that the choices becomes more easier. You know, when being asked to choose between what is right and which is apparently right, not necessarily the wrong. Always life is not black and white.
Correct.
But you easily take that right path. You know, I don't know, I mean, if you've read K. Munshi's series on the Krishna Avatar.
No, I have not. I've heard a lot about it.
It is beautiful. And one of the most beautiful things he does in that series is the way he sketches the character of Yudhishthira.
Wow. You know, just now when we spoke about these choices and you said that there's absolutely no dilemma, the first person that came to my mind was Yudhishthira or Dharmaraja.
Right. You know, absolutely, because that's what he says. For a normal reader, many of the choices which Yudhishthira made during the course of the Mahabharata,
they seem impractical.
Yeah, impractical would mean self-abnegating and, you know, would mean losses to his personal family, and in the, you know, they were the ones who were to lose most of the time he made the choices.
And in fact, it is not only the reader's prem. If we see the Mahabharata,
right, even
on many occasions, his own brothers, though they have great regard for him, in different manner they actually criticize and condemn him and ask him, boss, what on earth are you doing, brother?
Right.
And just you because know, you're the boss,
right,
you're doing all
that's
this.
Exactly what K. Munshi says. He says the difference between, you know, Dharmaraja and the other brothers. The other brothers were also good. You know, Arjuna was good, Nakula, Sahadeva and Bhima, they were all good. But the difference was Yudhishthira never faced a dilemma. He always made the right choice every time, bang on. You know, there was no confusion in his mind because he was so wedded to his righteous path. And he said, that's what is the difference. And when you say that the decision making becomes easier, I think that's what it is. When to be righteous and to make the right selfless choice becomes your second nature.
I got a very interesting incident here.
Okay.
This happened in Thrai Vrindavan. And this was narrated to me by one of the seniors and elders.
Okay.
It was a conversation where Swami had asked a brigadier to give a talk. I won't name the person, but this brigadier, he was speaking about life in the military, naturally, because his whole life has been there, and how one is trying to follow values and all that. A point came when he said that, when he came to these, you know, these moral dilemmas. He said when in the army, for example, not for example, in the army one thing is pakka, one thing is set in concrete, that is, you cannot disobey a senior.
Right.
You're told march.
Subordination.
Yes, no insubordination. You can be court-martialed for that. You are told march, you have to just march. Because that is trained so that in times of war and conflict and other things, when you need to take split-second decisions, you don't stall and go against the regiment by using your own brains. You right. just are supposed to obey. He says, now that, while it has its own virtues, becomes a problem when you're told to do something that's against your conscience. He said, at such times, it's a moral dilemma. Because you don't know whether you should follow your conscience, or you don't know whether you should listen to the order and follow the military code. So it becomes very tough and you don't know what to do, and he was presenting this as a dilemma.
Okay.
When Swami said that, that is no dilemma at all. So, you know, the brigadier felt a loss of face. So he turned to Swami and said, no Swami, it's a really big problem and this is something that I face and everybody faces in the army. Then Swami was, you know, nonplussed, didn't even show a slight excitement, nothing. Swami just said, you know, if you are commanded by a superior authority to do something that is morally wrong, that ethically wrong, or it's against your conscience, you need not show insubordination publicly, but immediately after you are dispersed, just go to him and say, sir, can I have 2 words with you?
Mm-hmm.
And then you just tell him that, sir, in my humble opinion, be sweet. Use sweet words, good words, but be firm and tell that this is wrong. Because Swami said he too has a conscience, he too has God in him. It will, the Lord in you will communicate to the Lord in him. And then the brigadier, not to be outdone, he said, Swami, you know, that doesn't work every time. Swami says, so what? So Swami, if it doesn't work and it goes bad, you'll be court-martialed. Swami said, so what? He said, Swami, don't you know what is a court-martial? Swami, then my wife and children will be down on the road, Swami. That is what will happen. They'll be out on the streets. They'll be kicked out. It's an ignominy. Swami said, so what? And then this elder was telling me that Swami then said, you know, you lack faith in dharma.
Mm-hmm.
You lack faith in the truth that dharmo rakshati rakshitaha. You know, if you protect dharma, that will never ever happen. That will never ever happen. How do you know, Swami? I mean, the incident ends there, but you know, the thing will, how do you know, Swami? I know it, you follow it, you will see. Because, you know, I was reminded of this incident because when you speak of Yudhishthira and the Mahabharata, Prem, you will remember even in the dramas put up in front of Swami, when we read the book or when we watch the serial, how many, doomsday prophecies are told to Dharmaraja, to Yudhishthira? By his own brothers. Brother, you keep doing this, we'll be on the streets.
Right.
Our wife will have to beg on the road. We will lose everything. It is told again and again and again, and yet Yudhishthira doesn't yield. And what happens? In the end, Yudhishthira becomes a sovereign of the earth. And the proof, like they say, the proof of the pudding lies in eating. That's what it is. You have to, there's no guarantee that can be given. You just have to do it in faith. But what a guarantor we have got. Swami says, and this is not the first time, I also remember another industrialist devotee.
Mm-hmm.
During an industrial tour, he brought out a dilemma like this only. And he asked the students that here is a contract that I have to secure for the company, because my company has so many 1,000 employees, and their food and shelter and all depends on me paying them, and me paying them depends on my profitability depends on me getting this contract. So what is there if I pay this little bribe? So, you know, when the students tried to argue against the bribe, he said, come on, be a realist. See, this is what happens in our so-called day-to-day and worldly life.
Mm-hmm.
We say all the spirituality is good. But when it comes to hardcore life, you say, come on, be a realist. I remember this because this happened even to me, you know, when a police took my license. It felt so easier to pay a 50 rupee bribe than to pay a 300 rupee, which is 6 times higher, the fine. Because my pocket money entirely would have gone for that. And I am proud to say that having failed twice, the third time I did not pay the bribe and I paid the whole amount. And I decided I won't make the mistake of whatever I had done on each of those occasions. But the first 2 times, it was much easier to pay the bribe. And this is what he told. He said, come on, be practical. In the name of practicality, we lose our faith. And when this was again in the evening, you know, after every industrial tour, we would meet Swami at Thrai, and during the Thrai session, Swami would inquire into the industrial trip. This was, I think, 2 years our seniors. When they told Swami that this happened, Swami again said the same thing. Swami said it only shows lack of faith in dharma. If you stick to dharma, dharma will surely triumph. So when that faith in dharma is so strong, then as you said, choices are so easy to be. There's nothing like a choice. It's not as if the choices have vanished. It's just that you know that this is the right choice and I'm taking it. It's not that the number of choices have reduced. The choices remain the same, but your choice becomes so easy. So I guess another way, as I said, to measure spiritual progress is to see how many times or how intense is our dilemmas.
Absolutely.
The less intense and the less number of times, the more progress.
And I think in a sense, you know, what Yudhishthira stood for is the ideal. And we can compare. When we were in undergraduate, one of the toughest papers the BCom students used to face was the income tax paper. And there was some, you know, you have these long calculations you have to make. And invariably it was to be difficult to get the right answer. So, you know, the way they used to see whether they were right was, they would go to the person who was the topper of the class and ask him what was the value he got. And comparatively they'll see how much they've gone wrong.
Okay.
You know, because none of them would have got it right. And even if he has got it wrong, he wouldn't have got it more wrong than they would have got it.
So you know, like a benchmark.
Right. So I think in that sense, maybe somebody like Yudhishthira or, you know, what Swami would expect of us is that ideal person who has no choices to make. You know, every time he knows what is right. And, you know, even as you say that, it calls for another quality to make that right decision all the time. Even with the examples that you gave. I think I've mentioned this before. You know, there was this, one of the Sikh gurus. He was imprisoned by the Mughal king. You know, because he was trying to propagate a religion which was other than Islam and it was not acceptable. So he was invited to the Mughal court in Delhi and in the name of an invitation he was imprisoned. So when he was in the prison, he was going through a lot of torture in the hands of these Mughal rulers. At that time there was a Sufi saint who was very friendly to this, you know, Sikh guru. His name was Pia Mir Muhammad, I think. He was supposed to be one of the very famous Sufi saints of that period.
Okay.
So since he had very good access to the Mughal court, he also got to go and meet this person in the jail. And I think, yeah, Sikh Arjan Dev Singh.
Arjan Dev,
it's the story from his life. So he goes to him and this, you know, Pir Mia is so shocked. He said, Guru, you're so powerful. He said, if you will, you can just bring down this entire clan to dust. Why are you putting up with this, you know, suffering and ignominy? Why are you allowing people to torment you like this? And then he goes on to say that, okay, if you don't want to do it, if you feel that it would be a selfish act, you permit me, I will do it for you. You know, because he was no less,
the Sufi saint.
Right, Sufi saint was no less a person. So he said, I will do it for you, I'll bring down this whole clan down. So then, you know, Arjan Dev gives a very, very beautiful statement. He says that if I can do it, you know, I can afford to do it, I have the powers, but I will be setting a wrong precedent for those normal people who will follow me. I have to tell them that if you want to stick by the truth, you have to stick to it at any cost. You know, otherwise people would say that, yeah, you had the powers and, you know, you could...
That's why you could afford to stick to the truth.
To do it.
Because if you get into a mess,
right,
you can easily extract yourself out.
So he said, I have to do it the normal way so that the normal people who come later will draw inspiration for my life. And I remember when one of our lecturers were telling us this episode, one of the students said, sir, but isn't that a wrong precedent? Because he's telling that it's so difficult to stick to truth. Isn't it an example of how much you will suffer if you choose to stick to truth? And, you know, promptly that lecturer gave an answer which was very, very profound and I stick to it. He says, truth is not for the cowardly.
For the weak-hearted.
For the weak-hearted. He said, that is the lesson. That is also the lesson which he's trying to say, that if you want to stick to truth, if you want to stick to the right path, you cannot be a coward. You need to be fearless.
So we come to the next point. I think that is a very, very important point to measure our progress on the spiritual path, is to see how fearless we are.
Right.
You know, when we speak of fearlessness, my mind travels in different directions. For instance, I remember once during the satsang how I had narrated about how desire leads to fear.
Right.
You know, about that getting a permission to go to Singapore, and it was narrated in great detail. I don't remember in which satsang. But basically, fear comes wherever there is desire, because when desire is not getting fulfilled, that is fear. But today, you know, I wish to go a little deeper into this thing about fear. You know, it was, again, this is another thing that we have discussed in the satsang. We were talking that day about sugar being sweet, if you remember.
Right.
And just for the sake of our listeners who might have missed that out, we will reenact that little thing that we did. Say, Prem, suppose you have had sugar, and you know sugar is sweet. Now, what will you do if somebody, if your friend comes and tells you that Prem, sugar is bitter, it is not sweet? What will you say?
That you won't agree with it because
yes,
you have experience to stand by.
Exactly. And what if your parents say the same thing to you?
No, you won't agree with it.
Yes. What if the scientists come and tell you that we have done research and this is the finding and this is not the truth, so sugar is bitter, then?
The same thing. You know, you always go by what you've experienced.
Exactly. But what if I put a gun to your head and tell you, Prem, if you're going to say that sugar is sweet, I'm going to shoot your brains off. Then what do you do?
You obviously love your life more than the sweetness of sugar.
Naturally. So you'll compromise. But what if I tell you, for example, that if you, I don't point the gun to you, I point it, say, to a pot at your home. And I say that if you say that sugar is sweet, I'm going to shoot this pot.
Then it wouldn't matter much to me.
Exactly. So, you know, by this, we realize that it is this body attachment that makes us swerve from the path of truth. It need not be your head, Prem. Suppose I keep the gun to your mother or your sister or your father's head also, you will still say sugar is sweet. Sugar is bitter, I mean. Because you feel they are mine. The attachment is there. To whatever we are attached to, for that sake we will swerve from the path of truth. But when it comes to a pot, I don't care. You can shoot the pot all that you want. Sugar is sweet. The same thing, we don't care for any other thing also. Even if our parents tell us that sugar is bitter, we say, no, sugar is sweet. Your experience may be bitter, but don't, you can't convince me. So you see, fearlessness is very intricately and completely intertwined with what we are attached to. And if we are not attached to anything, we will be fearless always.
Right.
And that is what happened with Swami. You know, when they cut Swami's head, because he said, I am Sai Baba, I am God. You know, it was like him stating the truth, saying sugar is sweet. It was not sugar is sweet, it was I am God. When he said, I am God, they tonsured his head. They scratched his head, put him in a pit filled with dung and neem leaves, and all the kinds of tortures. But for Swami, his body was not him. He did not have the attachment that you and I have towards our body. And therefore, he could continue to be fearless and truthful even in face of such, in quotes, grave danger. So I feel fearlessness comes from our ability to be detached from the body and have Atma Abhimanam, as Swami calls it.
And I think that is why fearlessness is a wonderful scale for you to measure your progress. Because eventually what you're trying to do in a spiritual path is to become less attached, right? You know, that's the goal when you reach that state of absolutely being detached from everything else. So a visible sign of that losing your attachment is the fearlessness which comes out. And that's why the more fearless you are, and you know, when you say fearless, it's not the kind of arrogance which comes with a carefree nature. It's not that fearlessness, but the fearlessness to stick to what is right. Fearlessness to do, I remember even as I'm telling this, you know, one thing which all of us go through when we take to a spiritual path is a kind of shyness. You know, there's peer pressure. How can you do bhajans? You know, I remember all some of the boys used to face that when they go home. You know, you're a 17-year-old boy or an 18-year-old, you're a teenager. You're going and doing bhajans, you're going and doing seva, you go and clean the toilets in your hostel. You know, the kind of ridicule. We were protected from that because we were staying in the hostel.
Mm.
But that is something which most people face when they take to a spiritual path.
Mm.
They say, you know, this is supposed to be for those post-retirement and you know, why are you taking up this? You will be able to stick to those things only if you are absolutely carefree about what others think of you. And a kind of unabashed fearlessness. You know, that's what we're talking about.
Yes, and it's also an important distinction that you made there. You know, the so-called cool attitude, and it's not that kind of carefreeness in the sense, you know, you go, for example,
right.
I was seeing in a zoo there, you know, there is this guy, a youth, mm-hmm. he's trying to tease the chimpanzee over there, you know.
Okay.
He's trying to tease the chimpanzee there and I don't know whom he's trying to impress, but apparently these are things that we do, you know, tease a chimpanzee in a zoo, or maybe, you know, try some driving stunt when we're on the road, or, you know, just stretch beyond just to show off in the sense. You can make out that this is show off and not courage or bravery by two things. One is, if it's courage or bravery, it will be done if it is needed alone. If it's being done when it's not needed, it's just a show off. And the second thing is, when it's courage and bravery, it will be courage and bravery throughout. Not like, for example, in this case, the chimp suddenly got irritated. It just picked up a rock that was inside and flung it with such force, which came and rammed at the, you know, rails there.
Okay.
This guy jumped back 10 feet and he was definitely scared. Means all the courage that he had vaporized into thin air, and there you could see him having real genuine fear, and he did not go towards this cage, and everyone around also told him, you keep away from the cage, keep away from this huge enclosure. So you see, while a carefree attitude is a good way to see fearlessness, it is not actually like this if courage is displayed when it's not needed, or courage is only momentary and when tables turn around, you are scared. It's always easy to scare a tight dog. But when a dog comes barking at you, that's a different ball game. And also another important distinction is, when we say fearlessness, it is not the question of overcoming fear.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for example, if I have to walk across two buildings. See, here I'm saying if I have to walk, if there is a need. It's not as if I walk on my own, but there is a need. If it's a life and death matter and I have to cross. At that time when I'm walking across two buildings on a narrow ledge, for example, it's not a case of me overcoming fear by taking slow deep breath, calming down myself and telling myself don't look down and holding on, and then I chant the name of Swami and do that. Now that helps me overcome my fear. But if I am rooted in the faith that, you know, like Swami was, that I am not the body, I don't have body attachment, then just like Swami asked the brigadier there, so what? So what if you're court-martialed? So what if you have to be on the street? The same question will come, so what if I fall? Because I'm not going to die. Nainam chindyanti shastrani, that's what is there in the Bhagavad Gita, that fire can't burn, weapons can't hurt me, water can't wet me, because I am the immortal Atma. We know it theoretically. But if that becomes part of our being, then we feel no fear, because actually when I fall, the body gets hurt, nothing happens to me. So you see, there's a difference between overcoming fear versus being fearless. And actual and real fearlessness comes by overcoming body consciousness.
In a sense, this will not be a very easy thing for most people. You know, let's be honest with that.
Yes. I mean, it's not easy for you and me also.
Right. Yeah. Going beyond body attachment is something which we are trying to do because Swami likes it. Let's be fair with that.
Correct.
You know, it's not something which I wanted to do when I joined Swami's university.
Exactly.
That was not in my checklist to overcome body consciousness. But given that, you know, when we talk of ourselves as Swami's devotees, or all of us are devotees of some form of divinity or the other, you know, that devotion to that Lord, that itself has the ability to give an immense amount of fearlessness, and that comes out of surrender. You know, whenever we talk of surrender, we've told this many, many times, what Swami has told, that the best way to surrender is to tell yourself and remind yourself again and again that whatever happens is good for me. Which means, you know, it's, you know, mentally imagining that I am here and there is Swami always behind me, and he's ensuring that, and he's like that universal filter which says that I'm going to filter out everything else and send to you only that which is good for you.
That which you need.
That which you need and that which is good for you. Nothing other than that is going to come for you. And you know, I used to imagine this when you're walking down on a dark road, and there are so many stray dogs in Parthi, or you know, you always have the fear of some other spirits or anything else, because we used to take walks on that road where you have the symmetry to your left.
And you know, there are a lot of dogs there. I remember somebody told me that all those dogs come barking at you, but don't worry, because barking dogs don't bite. You know, I know it, he knows it.
What about the dog?
That dog should know it, right? I mean, if it comes and bites me,
what do I do? But you know, that's what I used to think, that it's not that I was very fearless, but I used to think that if I really have surrender for Swami, I should have, you know, I should have no fear that this dog is going to come and bite me. Even if the dog bites me, the idea is, if the having been bitten by the dog is not good for me, Swami is not going to allow that dog to touch me. Are we will we be able to go and lead life in that feeling of fearlessness?
Now, this is a very, very practical point which definitely we can take up to measure our own progress, spiritual progress in a quantitative manner. Definitely. How many times are we able to celebrate everything in life? Because if I am convinced that everything that is happening is because it is good for me, and that, as we said, is the definition of surrender that Swami has given, to think and to consider everything that has happened to me as good for me. Now, when I am able to live really in that feeling, then isn't it true that I should celebrate every moment of my life? I should be happy every moment of my life, because every moment of my life is being planned by Swami. And that automatically leads us to another indicator, which is happiness. A sure sign of spiritual progress is just being happy all the while. Because when I have surrendered, all that is happening to me is only good for me. And when so much good for me is happening throughout the day, why on earth will I not be happy?
You know, there used to be one short one-liner which we used to tell ourselves very jocularly. Not that it's something which Swami said or anything. We used to tell ourselves, if you are Saidas, you live life bindas.
Wow. I mean, those who do not know Hindi, Saidas meaning a follower or almost a servant of Swami, and bindas meaning without a single care in life.
Right. Because, you know, that's how you have to lead our life, and that's how we will lead our life if we really trust and place all our faith on Swami.
You know, I'm reminded of that beautiful incident which you narrated of Mrs. Geeta Mohan Ram.
Right.
And how she was able to use this concept of surrender in a very practical situation, because that gives us inspiration to use this surrender in day-to-day episodes in our life. But I think, Prem, we will retain that for after the break. We will take a break now. So, dear listeners, don't go away anywhere. Be here. There's an interesting incident. And we will follow that up with a few more pointers on how we can measure our spiritual progress. Hope you are enjoying the session with us and Swami here. And here's a little break, after which we'll be back.
जिंदगी के राह में चलते रुकते नहीं बढ़ते साई हम सफर बढ़ते कदम रखते न हम साई के प्यार को पाले हम बढ़ते कदम रखते न हम साई के प्यार को पाले हम
Welcome back, dear listeners. You're listening to the Afternoon Satsang, and we are in the middle of a satsang where we're talking about how does one measure one's spiritual progress. And we were talking about fearlessness being one of the measuring aids.
And fearlessness which comes because of surrender.
Surrender, right. And that is the point we are in at right now. This is about an incident which happened with Mrs. Geeta Mohan Ram, one of the long-standing devotees of Swami, who lives in Washington, D.C. now. And she narrates, you know, this happens during one of Swami's birthday celebrations. Mm-hmm. That was one year when she was not able to come for Swami's birthday celebrations because she was made the coordinator of the education wing in her center. So she had a lot of duties for the celebration there in the center. So she couldn't make it that year.
Mm-hmm.
So she was saying that the day before, on 22nd November, she had gone out for shopping. And you know, you have these drive-in ATMs. You don't have to get out. You just have to drive close enough to the ATM machine, open the car door, and you can encash. So okay. When she had stopped at one particular drive-in ATM like that, and when she opened the door, she could see on the rear-view mirror, there was somebody who was running, dashing across the lawn, and he opened the back door of the car and got in.
Okay.
Okay, and the next moment, she realized that he had put an arm around her neck with a knife at her throat, and he said, drive, drive, drive. You know, apparently he wanted to steal something, you know, appear like a robber.
Hmm.
And she says that for some reason she didn't panic. You know, and she was wondering, you know, it's really a life and death situation. And we spoke about how stress was meant to be for such situations.
Yes.
When, you know, you're supposed
your heart
to,
beats faster
your mind stops thinking and your all other parameters slow down and you're supposed to panic, right? And then that's the natural thing. And for no reason, she felt that she was absolutely calm. And she told him that if you want the money, you can take the money. You know, you don't have to harm me.
Hey, just coincidentally, Prem, I remember when we discussed stress also, we talked about surrender being a way of overcoming stress.
Right, right.
So
exactly.
Okay.
And, you know, she said that if you want the money, you can take the money. When I'm not... So the first thing is she was detached to the money she was having. You know, it was not like... I would save the money even at the cost of my life. It's not that way. She said, yeah, you want, you can take the money. Money is nothing.
Mm.
And then he said, no, I don't want the money. Just drive. Don't talk. Just drive. And he said that the police is after me. I want to escape from here. So I want to use your car. So just drive me out of here. And so she said, see, I cannot start driving unless I close my door. And by the time she could get herself inside and close the door, she saw that two police cars came and, you know, surrounded that car and blocked it off. And immediately two officers got down and they came towards the car and then they realized that he had held her hostage.
Mm.
So he can't come in, you know, they can't come and try to do anything to him. So she says that, you know, there was a picture of Swami on the windshield, which from the position she was sitting in, she could stretch and touch Swami's picture. And then she started talking with this guy.
Mm.
And she says, see, you're not going to get anything out of doing this. Mm. Okay. She said, you can take the car. You can kill me if you want, but I have nothing. I'm not so attached to my life because my children are grown up. They're going to do well. and everything is settled. I don't mind even dying now. You know, that's what she was telling him.
Mm.
But eventually you'll get caught. But finally, if you're getting caught, you'll be caught for murder, theft, and you'll be in prison for life. A better thing would be to give yourself up now and get yourself in prison for 2-3 years. And then you can come out. You know, this guy was really shocked that there was this lady sitting here and he was having the knife to her throat and she was doing counseling to him. Okay, and this guy was listening to her and he was so amazed by the calm and peace with which she was dealing with the situation. And in fact, the guy asks Geeta Mohan Ram, aren't you scared?
Hmm.
And she says, no, I'm not scared. I have no reason to be scared. And she says, I'm not worried at all. I'm just worried about you. What would happen to you if you were going to do something stupid now?
Hmm.
And eventually she manages to convince this fellow. So he says, yeah, and he says that, I think what you're saying is right. I'll give myself up.
Hmm.
And he gets out of the car and goes and surrenders to the police. And later, I think this was in 22nd November, as I said, on 24th November, Swami came to her parents, Dr. Padmanabhan, you know, during darshan and asked, how's your daughter?
Hmm.
And by then they had not come to know of the whole situation, and Swami narrated the whole thing as it happened.
Okay, wow.
And she said, see, your girl is still mad. She's going to the police and talking about a lawyer for that convict. You know, that is what happens. See, there are multiple things in this.
Hmm.
One thing is, the kind of things which strike me here is, she herself was surprised by that fearlessness which came out then. When we are talking about measuring our spiritual progress, I think that's one thing, that our ability to handle situations and our fearlessness will surprise even us.
Hmm.
It is not something we would have been conscious of. Because situations like this we don't come across every day in life. And when you find situations like this coming, it's like a small test which Swami is giving so that you can assess yourself.
Hmm.
You know, end of the day, Swami is going to take care of you in that situation. But it's a situation put there for you to assess yourself. Like what happened with Mrs. Geeta Mohan Ram. She says that that time she realized that she was so fearless. And the second thing is the ease with which she forgave that person who came to harm her. You know, at the end of it, she was trying to get an advocate and make sure that he gets the least term or something and gets out. You know, she was trying to help somebody who came to harm her. I think that also is one sign of somebody's spiritual progress.
Wow, that is really a beautiful point you have made, Prem. But before we go on to that point, I want to catch on to one more point that you made about, you know, test that Swami puts. We often say that Swami is testing me, you know, these are testing times. When we say such things, our attitude is as if Swami is an evaluator. He has no idea of how advanced or how backward we are.
Right.
He wants to check our progress, so he's subjecting us to a test, at the end of which he will evaluate us. You know, that's such a stupid thing, because what is there that Swami does not know? Swami knows my progress through and through. He knows where I stand. He knows where, how much I have to go, everything. So as you said, rightly said, a test is put so that I can evaluate myself and I can get to know where I stand.
Right.
A test in that sense, if we have to find its equivalent in the material world, it is more like Swami's test is like a worldly report card. It is like a card which shows us how much we have progressed, how much back we are, because it helps us to evaluate ourselves. And I think this is something we should keep in mind always, because we often think of Swami's tests as the test that we take in our material world,
right,
in our classroom for our academics. A test where the examiner has no idea of about our progress and wants to judge us. So that is a very, very important...
Right. And many, many times Swami has mentioned this, you know, be ready to welcome such tests.
Hmm.
Because these are the ones which show you whether you're progressing or not. Many times in discourses, Swami has said that, right?
And Swami has said that a fifth grade examination will not be, a fifth grade test will not be put to a first grader. A
right.
first grader will not be subjected to the fifth grade test. So, if a real tough test is coming your way, it just means that you are capable of that test. And that is the reason why it is being, you know, you are being subjected to that. And it's all about you learning more about yourself as to how much you have progressed. Now the other point that you are making of how Mrs. Geeta Mohan Ram was able to confer and convey her love on somebody who tried to harm her. When we went to the root of fearlessness, we arrived at the truth that true fearlessness comes from absolute detachment from the body.
From the body.
Lack of body consciousness. I mean, you do not treat yourself any different from the others. Reverse of stating the same thing, that you do not treat yourself as different from others, is you treat everyone else as part of you. And that is the secret behind Swami's selflessness and absolute love. Because for Swami, everyone, everything, whatever we see in the world, in the universe, is a part of Him. And so Swami finds it so easy to love everything, because everything is a part of Him. So this kind of expansion love that Swami calls comes with fearlessness, which comes from lack of dehabhimanam or giving up body attachment. You get fearlessness. Another result of that is selflessness also. So selflessness is not something that I consciously try to imbibe in me, saying that, you know, I have to help him, I have to help everyone. It is just that I have become fearless because one result of giving up body attachment is fearlessness, where I feel that I am not the body. And another result of, apparently paradoxical result of giving up body attachment, is selflessness, where you feel everyone is actually me. So I am not the body, it doesn't mean that I am making myself small. I am not the body because I am the body and much more, I am everything else. And that gives rise to selflessness, because I see everyone as part of me.
Right, and that is what we would like to call it as self-expansion.
Mm.
Because this process is also a process of self-expansion. So all those traits which come when you are able to see more people as part of you, all these traits, you know, when we talk of forgiveness, that's one trait which comes out of that feeling. When you talk of trying to correct somebody who is wrong and not put down the person who is wrong, I think that also is a very direct sign of that. Because, you know, till now, normally what we would do is, it's like shopping in a shopping mall. You know, you would pick up things which are nice, and those which are rotten, you would leave them out.
Hmm.
But the attitude with which you will deal with people will become like, suppose I have a part of my body which is unwell. You know, I might get disturbed by it, but I'm not going to discard it. I'm going to see how am I going to get that working back to working correct. Care for it, right?
Yes.
And that's what you would do when you come with difficult people, when you come face to face with difficult people. You're not going to try to condemn them or try to throw them out of your life, but you're going to see how to correct them and how to help them out. Because your welfare depends on them being well too.
Because they're part of you.
They're part of you.
And as we discussed the first two points, all these become qualitative ways. But we can easily quantify them with those two terms, frequency and intensity.
Right.
Again here, how frequently am I able to treat everyone as part of me? And how intensely am I able to treat everyone as part of me? Using these two parameters, I think we will be able to quantify each of these qualitative measures by which we can see how much we are progressing. So, how often in a day am I able to, you know, sympathize or empathize, have compassion on people? I remember in a talk, Professor G. Venkatraman, he beautifully brought out the difference between sympathy, empathy, and compassion.
Okay.
These three look like synonyms, but he said, you know, at the lowest level you have sympathy. In sympathy you see somebody suffering and you just feel sorry for them, that's it.
Right.
You know, oh, they are suffering. In empathy it is slightly higher. In empathy, you actually know what it means.
Mm-hmm.
For example, if somebody comes and tells me that, you know, it has happened before that as a mother she lost her child, maybe I can sympathize with her. It becomes difficult for me to empathize with her because I don't know what it is to lose, what it is for a mother to lose a child.
Right.
So when you are able to identify, you have also undergone a similar thing, and therefore then it's one level higher, it's empathy. So you know, it's not possible for you to have empathy always, because it's not possible for you to have all life experiences. Sympathy is the lowest level, but compassion, you know, sir was saying that compassion is when all these feelings do not stop at feeling level, but they concretize into actions. And that is where, you know, we see Swami's life as such an example. He didn't stop at sympathy or empathy. It was always compassion, because all those feelings always resulted in something grand, in something concrete. So now I may not be able to empathize with a mother who has lost her child, but I can definitely show compassion. I can do things that will make her life feel better. And you know, of course, nothing can fill in the vacuum of that great loss, but compassion definitely will be perceived, it will definitely be felt, and that joy of compassion will get conferred in some way or the other without doubt. So, the more sympathetic, the more compassionate we are, the more compassionate we become, the more spiritually progressed we are.
Even as you are giving those three differences, another thought which strikes me is, mm-hmm. when you talk of empathy and sympathy, you are always talking about a certain amount of comparison. When you say that to empathize, you should have gone through that. When somebody comes and tells their problem, you would always compare it with your life. And if you feel that you have lived a life which is filled with more difficulties than what the person is telling, it would be very difficult to empathize with that person.
Exactly. You will think, what on earth
are you
speaking?
Right, what big problem are you talking about? I face much bigger problems. So in a sense, there is a sense of comparison which happens when you empathize and when you sympathize. But the compassion part is, you know, for Swami, none of our problems were ever problems.
Exactly.
In his level, nothing which we went up to him and cried about was anything to cry about.
Correct.
But Swami never belittled it. You know, from his level, he could have. But he always, you know, he felt that there was no reason to pray for you or to, you know, to care for you, to love for you. When I have to feel compassionate to somebody, I don't compare his pain or her pain with my pain. I say that, okay, you are in pain, you know, what solace can I give you? What comfort can I give you? I think that's the difference, that's also one of the differences between compassion, empathy and sympathy.
A result of this self-expansion that we are speaking about is something very, very beautiful. When you expand yourself to include everyone else as part of you, one magical thing that happens is, you know, we spoke of one side of it, that is when you're able to feel others' pain. When you're able to help. But the other side of it is, you're able to feel others' joys too. I remember an incident when I was in high school. Whenever Swami used to materialize Vibhuti, the students had the chance of running up to Swami with a handkerchief and Swami would wipe his hand. And I had made this as my, you know, my method of getting chances with Swami. So I always had a kerchief with me and I would always be on an alert for Swami waving his hand. I remember once Swami just waved his palm and even before the first circle was complete, I had got up, I had sprinted till there and I pulled out my kerchief. It was in the general, public section, the crowds. And when Swami completed waving his hand three more times, instead of the fluffy ash Vibhuti, out came a ring, you know. I remember that where I felt like a fool and returned back because, you know what, Swami also looked at me because it was a ring. But most of the times when Swami would materialize Vibhuti, I would rush to him and give a handkerchief. Now there was this classmate of mine and he was also equally interested in pursuing this kind of a career of offering kerchief to Swami whenever Swami creates Vibhuti. And so we would be in constant competition with each other. You know, I would keep looking out where this fellow sat. Oh, that is where he's sitting. So I know, understand his trick. And you know, if there is a special block where people with intense problems will be seated, medical problems and such things. So we would always try to get a spot opposite to that block because there's a high probability of Swami creating Vibhuti there. Now when I take one area, he takes another strategic location nearby. On a few occasions, it has so happened that both of us have dashed towards Swami. And Swami, in fact, made a face showing that he was upset with this kind of indiscipline. And there were occasions when the warden had banned both of us from ever running behind Swami with a handkerchief. And the ban was lifted after a week or two when he would say, okay. That is when, you know, one of my teachers in the hostel told a very beautiful thing. He said, you know, when Swami says expansion love, how does it practically translate? It just means that whether you get the chance or I get the chance, it is the same. And so he told, now if you see your brother getting the chance, and if you are able to feel the joy that he is feeling, then what is the difference? Because you are doing that for the sake of the joy more than anything else, that we do everything in our life for happiness and for the joy. Now if I am able to get that joy, whether X gets it or Y gets it or I get it, then it is so beautiful, you'll be happy always, right? We often think that joy lies in owning a Mercedes-Benz, in a Mercedes-Benz. But it is not in a Mercedes-Benz car, because if a Mercedes-Benz car were to give me happiness, then I should always be happy, right? Because there is a Mercedes-Benz car in the world always. No. I stick my joy to owning it, me wanting it. So it doesn't depend on any external object. It depends on what I feel. And therefore, if I am able to feel joy with everybody's joy, life becomes so beautiful. And, you know, this is another consequence of self-expansion.
Right. In fact, even as you're narrating that, I think as part of the 1990, Samukho Swami made one of these points there. You know, he said, you've written an exam and you're waiting for your results. And you go there and you see that you have failed. The list is put up. You see that you have failed. And then Swami said, why should you be sad? Can't you see the number of people who are there, whose names are there, who have cleared the exam and feel happy for all of them? If you can be happy for others' happiness, imagine you will be infinitely happy. But we choose to be happy only for what is good for us and what is bad to us. And you know, that also brings the other point of, which is again quantitative, when we're talking about quantitatively seeing. How much are you seeing those things which can give you happiness? In a sense, we've spoken about this before. Something like gratitude. You know, we all have reasons to be grateful. We all have reasons to complain also, let's be honest. It's not that we have no reasons to complain. But how much do you choose to give gratitude than you choose to complain? In fact, this is one of the points which one of the listeners wrote to us this morning. Of how much gratitude do you show? Because one thing which Swami says, and I think sometime a couple of weeks back, a science-wise message which we sent out, that beautifully Swami says that in worldly life, when you want progress, you have to look at somebody who is above you and aspire to reach that height. If you're a vice president in a company, you look at the president and say you want to become like that. If you're the president, you look at the CEO and say that, you know, that's my goal. These are the aspirations which keep you going in a worldly rat race. But in a spiritual life, you always have to look at people below you and see how much more grateful I should be for what I have.
Exactly.
And I think so that is a very, very quantitative way of seeing, are you giving more gratitude than complaining as you progress?
Wow. The point that we mentioned before, you know, where we are able to take joy from others' joy.
Right.
I don't know if you mentioned it in the satsang, but a very interesting point about a room filled with balloons. You know,
yeah, I think you can narrate it. I don't think we had the opportunity to
narrate it, right? So beautiful. Yeah. It was a small experiment done where 100 people were told that there are 100 balloons in a room, helium-filled balloons which are floating about. And each balloon has their name. And they were given the task of finding their balloon. And when they were let in, it was chaos. It was mayhem. You can understand how it is. 100 people rushing in for 100 balloons. And it took almost more than half an hour for each one to have located their balloons. And in the process of locating the balloons in that pell-mell, in that hurry, you know, because they were told that there are prizes for those who locate their balloon first. In that pell-mell, several balloons got destroyed. Then the same thing was done with a different condition. Again, 100 balloons were lit. And they were told, now, each of you have to rush in and gather the first balloon that comes in your hand. First, whichever it might be.
Okay.
And then that balloon, just find out whose name it is. You know, all the 100 of them know each other. You know whose it is, just go and hand it over to them. When they did this, in a matter of 5 minutes, everyone had their balloon in their hands. At the end of this, the person who conducted this experiment, he told all the 100 participants that, you know, that balloon is symbolic of happiness. When you are in search of your happiness, you do things in a hurry. It takes you a lot of time for you to find your happiness. And as a result of that, you actually burst so many others' happiness. Instead, if you just try to hand over the others' happiness, you will automatically get your happiness. Nobody loses their happiness. So your happiness lies in others' hands. I mean, it is so direct. I mean, others have, you give happiness to others and your happiness comes to you automatically. Such a beautiful message through such a practical experiment. I think that is definitely a sign of self-expansion. And as you said, when you're able to see this, now see, from this experiment itself, once I see how fast it is, how much grateful will I be to the 99 others, because they helped me to complete it in 5 minutes. And they also ensured that my balloon is not burst. how much grateful I should be to them. In fact, I remember one of our brothers in our workshop that we did just started by saying, when we get up in the morning, you know, we first thing we go to the toilet. There is water in the flush. You know, there's water coming. For the water to come, somebody has put on the tap somewhere. Somebody has filled the tank. The watchman in the building has pumped water into the tank and the corporation has sent water to the building. And then I read the newspaper. Somebody has ensured that the newspaper comes to my house. My mother or father cooks for me. And when they cook, they have bought the food from somewhere. I mean the raw materials. Somebody has grown those raw materials. So we just calculated on an average, for us to lead a normal day, we have to be grateful to at least 120 people. Just imagine 120 people to be grateful for, because I am able to lead my day normally. If not for any of these 120 people, my day will be bad or it will go wrong. Something will mess up. Imagine just going and opening the tap and there's no water. What a situation it will become. It happened today in our building because a monkey had pulled out the pipe. It was pell-mell at a home where there was no water coming in the bathroom. So what a thing it is. Now just imagine, for us to lead a normal life, if we have to be thankful to 120 people, this brother was saying, don't you think that when you do any action, the action should benefit at least these 120 people? Now that is self-expansion, where you also think of others benefiting from your actions because you are benefiting from the actions of so many others.
Small aside in what you said, you know, whenever I've this kind of a discussion has come up with some people, the argument which comes up is, you know, they are being paid. You know, why you need gratitude? You know, they're doing their job because they're being paid. I'm doing my job because I'm being paid.
Correct.
Why should there be gratitude in between?
Mm.
See, that again brings another point where the importance is given to the money. You know, where you're saying that the dealing is in money. If we can consider that the money coming in and going out is just incidental, that person is helping me, I am benefiting, I am helping somebody, somebody is benefiting. Incidentally, there's a transfer of money between each other. If we were to think like that, then it'll be easier for us to show gratitude. But rather we give, you know, predominance and importance to that money transfer which happens. They're saying that, yeah, he's doing it for money, I am doing it for money. So where's the question of gratitude and being thankful to each other? I think that also is one of the signs where the importance you give to the monetary aspect of, you know, the situations and events in your life is also could be seen as one of the ways you see how much you're progressing.
Beautiful. That is a really important point where we are able to, we don't assign a monetary value for each and everything.
Right.
Because that is a sure shot sign of spirituality, because somehow, I don't know, Prem, it looks like money and spirituality are poles apart, right? And that's why Swami also says, you know, money comes and goes, morality comes and grows. Obsession with money is something that is definitely denigratory on the spiritual ladder.
Right, because Swami often says that all the value the money has is because what you give value to it, right? You know, it's the men who give value to the money. That's what Swami says. And that focus shift is very important. So I think pretty much we have covered most of the important points, but there is one very essential point.
Yes.
Which we did mention before, but we'll have to go into it a little bit of detail.
Correct, Prem. Before we go into that point, I just feel as a helpful way, when we are seriously interested in knowing our spiritual growth and how we are progressing, it would help us to maintain a spiritual diary.
Right.
Where, you know, we listed out 6 or 7 qualitative aspects, and each of these qualitative aspects can be measured quantitatively by simply measuring the frequency and their intensity. So if we can have a spiritual journey, a very personal spiritual diary, I mean, where we make notes, by comparing that we will be able to see whether we are progressing, just like what will happen in a company. So that is one more practical suggestion that has come up in a few mails that we received. A very, very beautiful suggestion, because it helps us see it in black and white and helps us to plan how to do so. Maintaining a spiritual diary, maintaining a personal diary. I feel really, you know, even I know this because I have maintained so many personal diaries. They might not be a spiritual diary in the sense that it is used for measuring my progress, but I have noted down anything and everything that I feel is related to Swami and my life, because I feel those are the only things worth cherishing. You open my personal diaries, you won't see any much mention about other people and other events and incidents. It's all about Swami, Swami and Swami related, because finally I feel in life the most important things are the spiritual things, are what helps us in our journey towards our Lord. And therefore, whether it's a spiritual diary in terms of measuring progress or in terms of maintaining all our thoughts, feelings and words about our Lord Swami, it's a beautiful practice to have a spiritual diary. With that, we come to the final point.
And having spoken about all the ways of measuring your progress, no, I mean, let's begin with that short story which I was telling you last week also, which I read in a book. And the author of the book is also very interesting for our discussion. We'll come to a bit of him later. You know, the story is about a master who's very well known for guiding his students into the spiritual path and making sure that they reach their ultimate stage. So there's this one person who comes and joins under this master. And the monastery is such that you lead a few years, stipulated number of years, under the tutelage of this master. And then the master says that, yeah, you're ready to go. So this disciple too came and joined, and he spent those years with the master. And the master calls him and says, you are ready to go now. You seem to have learned all that I have to teach. And then he lets him go by extracting a promise from him. He says that every month you should write a letter to me,
okay,
describing your mental state or your how you are faring in life.
Your progress.
Right, okay. Progress. Submit and spiritual progress, card. Right. It's a spiritual progress because it's a spiritual master. So the disciple is very happy. He goes forth. And at the end of first month, a letter comes. And the other disciples go and give it to the master. The master reads it aloud. And there he writes that, Master, I'm in the bliss of oneness. Okay, I'm always happy and I'm always seeing the light and all that. So the master reads it and there's a frown on his face. He crumples the letter and throws it in the dustbin. And all the other disciples who are listening to this are really shocked. They said, you know, this is what we all are here for. And here is somebody who seems to have reached that state. And the master is not impressed at all. 1 month goes by. The second letter comes. And the second letter says, the master, the same light which is in me, I see it in everybody around. God is within and I see it in everybody around. And I'm seeing that oneness and feeling it even though I'm in a crowd. Master again reads it. There's a frown on his face. He tears up the letter and throws it into the dustbin. Again, all the other disciples are surprised. You know, it gives a sense that what does this master expect finally?
Correct.
You
I know? Mean, I think in all whatever we have discussed,
right,
he has already achieved.
Yeah,
them.
What does he expect? And then the third month comes and there's no letter. And the other disciples are wondering what happened, this guy is not written. Then the fourth month, fifth month goes by and there's no letter from this man. Then one day the master looks and he says that, what happened to this guy? He's not sending me any letters.
Progress, huh?
So he calls a couple of his disciples and he says, go in search for this man and ask him what is he doing and how is he faring. So they go in search of this man and he's in a dilapidated hut all by himself, sitting lost. So then they go and tell him that, you know, the master is waiting for your letter. They convince him that, you know, this is a promise that you made. You have to send a letter to him. So he casually picks up a piece of paper, writes something in it and gives it to the disciples and he says, you go and give it to the master. So they are all very eager to know what is there in it. They go to the master and they give it to the master. The master reads it and he jumps in joy and starts dancing. And he says, he has reached, he has reached. So all the other disciples are, you know, eager to know what he has written. And when they open that piece of crap paper which he has sent, in there are just two words which says, who cares? And the master was waiting for those two words because he said, you have not reached the ultimate as long as you are wondering, have I reached, have I reached, have I reached? If you're not, you know, the least bothered, does anybody know where I've reached or not? Or even you're not bothered to know whether you've reached or not. And that is the state where you really know that you've reached.
Wow. That's it. You know, I remember Swami having said once that once you're into the plane, don't try to count the miles. Because you know that the pilot is there and he will steer you. So all your worries and concerns are until you board the plane. Will I make it in time? How far is the airport now? When is the taxi coming? Where is it waiting? Is there a traffic jam? All these questions are until you get onto the plane. Once you get onto the plane, you just sit back and relax And that's what every captain says, you know, as you take off, he says, ladies and gentlemen, sit back and enjoy. There is my crew who will take care of you. Just enjoy, and once we land, we'll let you know. And that's it. You never bother to find out where it is, because when you land, you know it that you have landed. So that is the kind of attitude. I mean, though this is the ultimate thing at which Prem and myself arrived at the end of all our soul searching, dear listeners, we just felt that it would be wrong to present this right in the beginning, because then you would not go through the process that we went through, and so many other points, that beautiful point that came up along the journey. Because as they say, life is about the journey rather than the destination. That is true for spiritual progress as well. From what Swami says, Swami tells us, one sure sign of spiritual progress is when we stop bothering about spiritual progress.
But I think, again, the caveat is, we all go through spurts of that who cares moment. You know, we all have that, sometime when we say that, okay man, it's okay, it doesn't matter, Swami is going to take care. But as Swami has always said, you know, awareness is not important. Integrated awareness comes one step higher, but the highest is constant integrated awareness. That constancy is something which is so important. Are you able to be in that state always, all the time, given whatever is the situation? I think that's the thing. So, till we reach there, I think all those points which you made before are essential and are useful for one to, you know, judge oneself.
You know, in short, what you said, CIA is important for CIE. Constant integrated awareness is necessary for constant internal evaluation.
And beautiful. I think, you know, even as we are concluding, I'm reminded of one thing, what happened when Swami was talking to a group of Australian youth.
Mm-hmm.
Swami had given them a session in the bhajan hall, and Swami asked, if you have any questions, you can ask me.
Mm-hmm.
And one person asked the question which we are dealing with. Of course, he rephrased it in a different manner. He said, Swami, we're doing so much sadhana, we're doing bhajans, we're doing seva, we're doing all kinds of meditation. How do we know that we are getting purified from within? Because, you know, the scriptures say all spiritual practice is for chitta shuddhi. Is for the purity of the mind. So he says, how do we know that we are getting purified? You know, a different way of putting the same question which you have dealt with. And you know, the answer which Swami gave is very surprising. He said, when your process of purification starts, you will hear my voice within. And imagine, that's the starting point.
To hear Swami within.
To listen to Swami's voice within.
So, dear listeners, with that, we come to the end of this week's satsang, which was part 2 of this topic on how do I measure my spiritual progress. And the points that we discussed today are, one was fearlessness that comes out of lack of body attachment, and it's not about overcoming fear. But till we are able to reach that level, we derive fearlessness from our absolute surrender to Swami. Surrender in the sense that whatever happens to us in life, we consider it as good for us. The other way to measure is by seeing the ease with which we are able to choose the right path. That means lesser moral dilemmas, lesser doubts, lesser struggle in making choices. The next thing that was continuing with fearlessness was about self-expansion, where we become more selfless. We are able to celebrate in others' joys, and we actively work for the betterment of others through our compassion. Forgiveness increases, empathy, sympathy, everything. No need, there's no desire for revenge. And all these are symptoms of self-expansion. And finally, we come back like a running race, running the whole 400 meters, come back to the beginning of the track where we all started, where Swami says that when you are actually progressing spiritually, you are not actually bothered about how much you are progressing. And the starting point of your journey is when you are able to hear Swami's voice in your heart.
And the beautiful comparison which you gave when we were talking before, is that it's like a pilot who's caught, you know, in an unknown zone, air zone. All that he needs to do is, he has to make connection with the nearest control center. And once he starts hearing that voice, all he has to do is just follow it. That's all.
Exactly.
And I think that's exactly what we have come to. Because the most important thing is when you come and say, that I've bought the ticket, I've boarded the plane, I don't need to worry again.
Exactly. Prem, you know, maybe to complete, this is one small forward that I got it via Facebook, and it's very, very beautiful. It says, the 12 signs of spiritual awakening.
Okay, that's
very interesting. I thought we can conclude on this.
Mm-hmm.
And when we go through this, you will see that all of them have been discussed somewhere or the other in these two satsangs.
Okay.
The 12 signs of spiritual awakening. The first, an increased tendency to let things happen rather than try to make them happen.
Okay.
Frequent attacks of smiling.
Okay.
Feelings of being connected with others and nature. Frequent overwhelming episodes of appreciation. You know, gratitude, what we are talking. A tendency to think and act spontaneously rather than from fears based on past experience. Fearlessness. An unmistakable ability to enjoy each moment.
Wow.
A loss of ability to worry. A loss of interest in conflict. A loss of interest in interpreting others' actions. A loss of interest in judging others. A loss of interest in judging your own self also. That is what we came to finally. Gaining the ability to love without expecting anything in return. When you said the residual of all actions is just love. So these are the 12 signs of spiritual awakening. These are the indicators of progress. And dear listeners, hope that you enjoyed this journey with us as much as we enjoyed traveling with you and having the satsang. As always, we are very grateful to Swami, for He is the seed of all beautiful thoughts, words, and our actions too. He is the inspiration, He is the goal, He is everything. And it is indeed our privilege and pleasure that we got to know Swami, that we got to hold on to Him, and that we have got this most prized chance to love Him with all our hearts. With that, we bring this satsang to a close. After this little song, on the other side of the song, you will be greeted by Brother Chandu with his vibrant segment, Love to Love.
Bhagwan more naiya us paar laga dena. Bhagwan more naiya us paar laga dena. Ab tak to nibhaya hai, ab tak to nibhaya hai, aage bhi nibha lena. Bhagwan more nahi संभव है झंझटों में तुझको मैं भूल जाऊं. संभव है झंझटों में तुझको मैं भूल जाऊं, पर ना कहीं तुम भी मुझको न भुला देना. अब तक तो निभाया है, अब तक तो निभाया है, आगे भी निभा देना. भगवान मोरे नहीं इष्ट मैं उपासक तू पूज्य मैं पुजारी तू इष्ट मैं उपासक